Well, welcome back to Coast, Varla Ventura with us with her work, Varla Ventura's Paranormal Parlor, really cool book about ghosts, seances, and tales of true hauntings. Why don't you join us this hour and make a call and ask her a question or share a story with us. And welcome back, Varla Ventura with us. We talked about banshees. Let's get into some other things that you've done in your career, Varla, and in the book, of course, Paranormal Parlor. And where do people get the book, by the way, Varla?
Well, it's officially available. Today is its debut day, June 1st, so you can get it anywhere books are sold. It's available on Amazon, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble, your local little bookshop, Powell's. Most of those places should have it or should be able to order it for you in a short period of time because it's widely available.
The movement, the spiritualist movement, was very important for women back in the 1840s to the 1920s. How come?
It really was. You know, during that period of time, women didn't have a lot of options in terms of career paths. A lot of it was based on a conventional marriage, and you were expected to marry, you know, of your class or higher. You could become a proprietor if you were alongside your husband. And unless you were widowed, you often, you know, just maintained sort of a housewife status. And, you know, the other options, of course, were things like prostitution or becoming, you know, the head of a house of ill repute. Or you had, you know, a life of drudgery, like, you know, being going into a life of servitude and you know, maids or some other kind of ladies-in-waiting. So the if you were a woman of sort of the lower middle class especially, you didn't have a lot of options. You couldn't necessarily just explore any kind of career path. And in fact, if you had a well-to-do husband, you were expected to make him look good. So in order to sort of break free of that, that's part of the reason that the spiritualist movement took off in sort of these upper echelons of middle-class society in America and in England, but especially in America, that there were women who had, it was almost a way for them to be able to either be independent and not be married or make a name for themselves in a way that didn't, you know, I mean, this is a time, I mean, to this day, women are buried as Mrs. So, you know, Mrs. Harold Johnson. It's, you don't
right.
rarely even
they're,
see
they're,
her first name.
Who are they? So, right.
Yeah, who were they? And so, you know, you had a lot of women who gained incredible notoriety by becoming, so the psychic arts were a way for women to actually be more independent. And in the case of, you know, someone like the Fox sisters, or they were probably the most famous of their time. They made a tremendous amount of money. Now, they happened to be, they faked it. So they kind of went the other direction, and they have this incredible story where it was three sisters, and the oldest sister sort of managed the younger two sisters who were said to be the psychics. And I think actually they had some legitimate experiences in the beginning, but they quickly saw that they could make quite a bit of money. And so they, you know, I think this is very common in the psychic arts in general and to this day. You don't always get the psychic hit, but if you're being paid to get the psychic hit, you're going to just make it up. So they made up these elaborate stage shows with wrappings and levitating tables. And eventually the two younger sisters were drunks. And so they would travel around and they were just drinking and drinking and drinking. And the oldest sister and one of the cousins who was in on the whole thing eventually ratted these sisters out. So they sort of turned on each other. And these two incredibly wealthy Fox sisters died paupers. And the oldest one, who was sort of the manager, she did all right, but she had married and sort of settled down. So it's kind of this, that was sort of an extreme story. But you had a lot of women who were finding voices for themselves through the psychic art.
You had, there was a psychic type named Pearl Curran, who
mm-hmm.
channeled some kind of spirit called Patience Worth. A long time ago, right?
Yes. I think that was in like maybe 1916 to 1918 is when she was actually published. And so she was a St. Louis housewife.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Would, you know, attend these sessions and reportedly went into a trance during one particular session where she was with a medium. And she didn't claim herself to be a medium. She was attending a session and sort of dropped into trance and started channeling all of these different entities, but eventually sort of settled on this one named Patience Worth. And Patience Worth was this incredible poet and writer. And in fact, became widely published and received many accolades as being one of the best poets in America at the time of publication. So she really gained some notoriety for this work, but it was more than just a pen name. This was a woman saying that it wasn't her at all, but it was, you know, a divine entity that was dictating everything to her.
And there was also an incredible story of a novel that was apparently channeled by a Ouija board, claiming to be the ghost of Mark Twain writing the novel.
And what's interesting is that woman, her name was Emily Grant Hutchings, and she was actually the first person to bring a spirit board to the house of Pearl Koran. They were neighbors and friends, and they would attend seances together.
And a spirit board is a Ouija board.
A Ouija board, right. Because what we know today as the Ouija board, now we've used the term Ouija for hundreds of years, but the actual, now when we say the Ouija board, it was trademarked by Parker Brothers.
That's true, and they did very well with that.
And they've done very well with it. But yes, so it was also can be referred to as a spirit board, but essentially it's a Ouija board. And she would also bring her to seances and mediums, and that during one of those, I don't think that Emily Grant Hutchings was there, but that's when Pearl went into the trance and channeled Patience Worth. Well, Emily saw this success and actually kind of simultaneously started attending regular sessions with this particular medium. And the story is that the medium had multiple, this is all in the introduction to this novel that is said to have been channeled by the ghost of Mark Twain via the Ouija board. So imagine trying to, letter by letter, as you're moving the planchet around the Ouija board and then writing it down. And we're talking like a 50 to 60,000 word novel.
Jeez.
They allegedly painstakingly channeled it from these series of sessions. And what Emily's background, actually, she had met Mark Twain. So there's some suspect cast on her story, because there's a little bit of evidence in the archives, somewhere like UC Berkeley has the letters, that she had correspondence with Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, and that he had sort of jilted her a little bit, just sort of said, just write your own thing, you know, I can't tell you how to write. And she at the time was a journalist that was sort of traveling around. So anyway, he dies, and then she's at this session, and she supposedly the medium says, oh, he just said it's her. And then Emily had to sit down, and as soon as she put her hands down on the board and on the planchet, the thing started going crazy, and it said it was Mark Twain from beyond on the grave, and that he was going to tell this lost novel, but that she had to be at every single session. It had to be through Emily, and the medium was sort of the conduit. So it was Emily, her husband, who kind of acted as the scribe. But what I love about the story is that if you read the story, this marvelous introduction, they talk about how they sort of fashioned this Ouija board into something like a typewriter, and they put parenthetical marks on there and additional sort of punctuation and ways to sort of words that were common, contractions and things like that, so that they could sort of speed the process along. And all the time, you know, there's all these quotes of him saying things like, oh, I'm not the only one here. Everyone here wishes that they had a scribe on the other side, as if there's just this lobby full of ghosts wishing to find someone to tell their story to the living. It's really this kind of incredible story within a story. And then it takes a turn because she published it. She sold it to a publisher. But Samuel Clemens' daughter and his publisher found out, and they sued the publisher who was putting the book out because she was saying it was, you know, by Mark Twain. I mean, she said that on the spine. So they made them
give him credit.
Down. Yeah, and they made them take it down, and they destroyed all the copies, and so it never
Oh,
really saw the light
jeez.
of day. And she didn't really get the notoriety she had hoped. In fact, she was somewhat humiliated from it.
What's your gut tell you? You think it's possible? Can someone from the other side come back and do something that they love?
I do think that that's possible. I think that in this case, I think she believed what was happening. I think she believed the story, and I think she was an incredible storyteller. And I think that is why it became so convincing. And to me, what the best part of the story is the idea of, using this board, this spirit board, to create this lavish novel, and then sort of having this elaborate backstory. I mean, she closed all the loopholes. It's only today that we can look back and cast more of a skeptic's light on it and say, oh, well, there's some evidence to say that she had actually read all of his memoirs and knew that he was interested in the psychic arts and that he had attended a few seances and then sort of wrote scathing reviews of them. So there's, I mean, I feel as if there's an entire book that could be dedicated just to her and what really happened, and speculating on different things. But I think the best part for me is just sort of the setting of this woman finding a way out of what was probably sort of a boring lifestyle and becoming this, published author. And that's what she kind of always wanted to be. She sort of invented this persona. So.
Have you used the Ouija board, Barla, yourself?
Oh yes. Oh yes. Actually,
Why?
I was just talking with my sister about this earlier today because I thought, oh, this is probably going to come up, and I wanted to just confer with her. So I have a sister who's very close in age. We're Irish twins, technically. So we're very close in age. We're 11 months and 11 days apart. We spent, a lot of time together. And I asked her today, I said, do you remember doing, because I have really vivid memories of doing the Ouija board together as kids, the two of us. Sometimes my mom would do it. Usually my mom would be in the
She
room.
was part of it?
Oh, yeah, my mom would like ask the questions,
Oh,
and we'd be
boy.
sitting
I
there.
guess in those days people didn't think they were evil. Or
I
did
think
they?
some people thought they were evil, just not my
You weren't
people.
scared? You didn't think anything could happen?
I was pretty young. I mean, I'm not saying I was 3 or anything, but I was probably, I was under 10. All the audience is cringing. Imagine children playing on the Ouija
I
board.
know, they're
But
going nuts.
and the thing is my sister, she remembers being very scared. She said she remembered it moving, and she wasn't moving it.
That's the
And I
planchette.
said I wasn't moving it. And to this day, she's still like, there's a little bit of her is like, are you sure you weren't moving it?
You tricked
But
me.
she got scared and she didn't want to do it anymore. And I said, I don't remember being scared. I remember being fascinated and then mom taking it away. So, everybody has their own
You mean
perspective.
your mother, who was a part of it, got scared and took it away?
At a certain point,
Something happened.
yes. Yes, at a certain point, we started talking with the ghost of a little girl. And there was an old pioneer grave, a lone grave in the woods. I mean, it's just like the most freaky setting you could imagine. But there's a lone grave in the woods that our neighbor had stumbled upon. And she kind of told us about it. We had all kind of hiked through the woods and we had seen this lone grave, and it was of a little girl. And I remember it specifically because I was around the age that this little girl was when she had died. She was like 7 years old. And so we started seeing if we could, I mean, we were kind of actually looking for her to see if we could find anything out about her. And then I think what happened is we actually started getting correspondence. And I don't know exactly if it was a moment or just an overall feeling, but there was this particular time where I don't know, we were maybe asking the questions, and my mom was in the room, and we were kind of playing with it, and it was moving pretty rapidly, which anyone who's done the Ouija will find that there's sort of this kinetic energy that starts, so it moves slowly, and then it can actually start moving really frantically, and
Then
sometimes
it picks up the emotion of people or something.
Yes. And so I'm not entirely convinced that it actually was an entity talking to us, but that it wasn't something in our mind, sort of like more of a mind control kind of thing, where it was like, well, but we were so young, it was a little bit more subconscious. In any case, we weren't physically pushing it. And my mom walked into the room at a certain point, and she just picked the board up, folded it in half, tucked it under her arm, and left. And later she said to us, that she felt that there was something trying to talk to us, but she was not, she realized at that moment, she didn't think we would actually make contact with anything. And she thought, well, I think they've made contact with something. And she knew that often, you know, things will present themselves as, oh, I'm a little girl too.
Well, and you know, you're supposed to burn them to get rid of them.
Well, I don't know, but she will never, she has not told me what she did with it. And the last time I asked her, she said she couldn't remember. So we don't know what happened to it, but I expect it's long gone. It could be buried somewhere. She could have burned it, but it certainly was put away on a high shelf, and we didn't play with it at home.
We've got a guest and a friend, Varla, who loves the Ouija board. Her name's Karen Dolman. She just thinks they're the greatest tools that are out there. I don't get it.
Well, have you done the Ouija?
I did once, and it was a disaster.
Oh.
It was back in St. Louis, and I did it, and then I kept it in my broadcast studio, and it sat there, and everything went wrong in a studio that was pristine, that nothing went wrong. Everything was brand new. Things went wrong. Lights went on when they weren't supposed to. Computers died. Switches on the board, the audio board went crazy. It was nuts. I gave it away. I gave it to my producer, Howard. I said, Howard, get rid of this thing. Get rid of it now. He took it, and he's walking down the hall during the commercial break. Everything comes back on. Weird, right? So the computers start working. The light boards start working. And we would work our own boards in those days, too. I've got a great board operator now. I don't have to worry about that stuff. So Howard is gone during the commercial break, and he comes back, and he doesn't have the Ouija board anymore. And I said, great, you got rid of it. Yeah, he said, yeah, I did. And I said, good for you. And I just thought he threw it away. Jump forward about 2 months. I meet an old friend of mine who was in our news department at the time who got fired 2 days after this episode. And I hadn't seen him in 2 months. He was not a social friend. He was just an acquaintance friend. And I ran up to him. I said, Daryl, how are you? What happened? And he went, what happened? I lost my job. I lost my girlfriend. Everything went wrong when I took that blankety-blank Ouija board from your producer, Howard Morton, that night.
Oh.
Howard gave it to this guy, and his life was topsy-turvy after that.
Oh,
I won't touch him. I was going to do a Ouija board show with three special guests years ago, and canceled it. While they were here, we turned it into a different show. We were going to do Ouija board experiments on the air live. I canceled it. One of them talked me out of it for sure. There was one that said, I'm walking out if you do this. And, you know, it was mixed reviews. I would get emails from people who were having Ouija board pizza parties waiting for me. But I won't play with them. We're going to be back in a moment, Varla. We will take promised phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Varla Ventura as we talk about her work, Paranormal Parlor, and we're going to take calls now. So let's go to Edward in Roseville, California, to get us started. Hello, Edward. Good morning.
Hello, George.
Good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Hey, you said call in and tell you a story or two about ghosts. I've got a couple for you.
Sure.
Okay. Working as a correction officer over in Vacaville, California. I saw two different full-body apparitions. First one, working a unit, second floor, time to lock up the 200 inmates. Everybody stands by their cell doors. You go down the line, you lock the door behind them. Get to the end of my first tier. I always look to the left, make sure nobody's standing there before I walk across the tier to lock the other side. As I look up, I see an African-American guy, light-skinned, about 6 foot tall, short hair, standing on the wrong side of the grill gate that goes up to the next level. I lock my door and I yell, "What are you doing over there? Run over there!" And there's nobody there.
Oh.
Yeah, freaky. Okay, so I go down the line. I lock a few more doors. One of the inmates I have a good rapport with steps out and he goes, "Officer Bryan, what'd you see?" "I don't know what you're talking about. Go lock it up. Let's go." "No, Officer Bryan, I saw you running." He goes, "Seriously, what'd you see? Come on, tell me, tell me." All right. I explained to him what I just told you guys. And he goes, "Oh, that's inmate so-and-so." I'm like, "Who's that?" He goes, "Oh, that's homeboy. Used to be a couple cells down from me. He hung himself a few years ago."
Oh, my gosh. And they all know about it.
Yeah. And so he goes, "Yeah, ask your porter. That's the guy who works for you. Cleans everything."
Yeah.
He goes, "Ask him. He'll tell you about it." So later on that evening, I'm downstairs. My porter comes into my office, and I ask him about it. And he goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Did you see him?" I go, "Yeah." I go, "What's going on?" He goes, "Well," he goes, "you guys always yell at me at nighttime because I always put a little cardboard in my window so you can't see me when you're doing the cell checks. And you guys always tell me to take it down." He goes, "Well," he goes, "a while back," he goes, "I was reading a book in bed late at night." And he goes, "I got this eerie feeling. I look up, and there's a guy standing in my cell window staring at me." He goes, "But I could see right through him." I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "I started shaking. I yell at this guy, 'Get the heck away from my cell. Leave me alone.'" He goes, "So I'm watching this guy, and he turns around, starts to go away." He goes, "I got up, and I ran over there, and he was gone." And he goes, "And I've seen him a few times at nighttime." He goes, "And that's why I cover my window at nighttime when you guys come and yell at me."
Gosh, I love that story. Varla, you could use these for another book.
I know. I'm thinking correctional facility. And.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That could be huge. Edward, we're going to move on to some other calls, but thank you. That is a great story. Why would an inmate who dies, he hung himself, want to hang around a prison?
Yeah, that's a good question, you know, because people have a lot of theories about ghosts and are they people who are, you know, were interrupted? Are they people who were not finished here? Or is it just sort of an imprint and a memory of the suffering that someone went through? And, of course, we don't know any of those things. But we do know that frequently when someone dies by tragic means, their ghost is often reported.
You know, we've got the largest prisoner listenership of any radio show, and they're probably saying right now they can relate with this because they probably those people in that prison probably know this guy.
Well, one of the scariest, well, maybe not scariest, but one of the strangest places I had ever been to was Preston Castle, which is in California. It's in Ione, which is kind of like middle southern California, lower kind of foothills. And we spent a night there. Actually, I talk about this in the book. Two of my sisters, my mom and I, went on an overnight ghost tour there, where you had the option to sleep, but nobody could sleep. And the thing is it was a correctional facility for a number of years, and there's actually a correctional facility next to it now. And prior to that, it was sort of like a juvenile hall for boys, but then also during the Depression era, sometimes families would, like, just leave. You know, it was not exactly families, an orphanage, but families would give up a child to live there because they couldn't afford to take care of them. And it's very, very creepy there. There's just a lot of, for one thing, it's in a state of sort of half abandonment. So there's peeling wallpaper and abandoned hospital beds and dusty libraries and things like that. But there's also very sort of heartbreaking things like massive rooms where all the boys had to shower under supervision. A big pool where kids were dipped to de-lice them before they were given their uniforms. So there's sort of something about that, little bit of that dehumanization of someone going into an institutional setting that adds this other element of, just so there's a bit of heartbreak there. And we had a number of experiences, and I talk about them in the book, but one of my sisters had her hair kind of tugged lightly, and we caught several things on camera back when we did it when there were cameras and we didn't use our phones so much.
So many strange things, huh?
Yeah, it was an interesting place to go, and I think you can still go and do overnight tours there and photography tours. It looks like Hogwarts with bats running out of the rafters, and it's amazing.
Let's go to Albert in Phoenix, Arizona now. Welcome to the program, Albert.
I want to first say thank you to you. I've been listening for 10 years. You love people. You're just trying to figure out the science of the spirit world. The opposite of live, L-I-V-E, is evil. Anyway, as far as Ouija boards are concerned, when I was a kid, in my teens, there was a girl, and she was fine until one day she had this Halloween party, and she got a Ouija board, and she went totally berserk and ended up actually having to go to a priest, and they put her in an institution.
Oh, my God.
I was scared to death of Ouija boards, and I stay away from forever because I know there is a spirit world. The devil exists, and I think the spirit world is like, you know, we have cell phones, low frequency 2G, 3G, 5G. I think eventually we'll have equipment where we'll be able to find the right frequency that they're operating on and communicate with them. It's interesting that this Ouija board started from the Song Dynasty in China in the 1300s and then ended up in the Salem witchcraft trials and then spread in America.
Mm-hmm.
Anton LaVey's face is on there if you look for it. And all the people in prison, everybody that makes a bad mistake is because evil spirits take control of their body like a puppet and lead them astray. And then they, you know, not everybody's evil. It's just the spirits are evil. You know, it's like the devil made me do it, right? And so the thing is that I think that we need to study we need to have scientific approaches to finding out how to communicate with the spirit world and to help people, you know, technically to be exercised. In other words, somebody has an evil spirit, you can take them to a spiritual clinic. You know, if you look up the word idometer phenomenon, back years ago, scientist Faraday created an apparatus to try to communicate with the spirit world. So this, for people listening, it's not a joke. This is not like a shock theater. This is a real thing that Mr. Norrie's working on. So we all need to pray and understand that there is a spirit world inside of our bodies and ask God to direct us. I love the Lord, and I believe in Jesus Christ, and I am totally aware of the entire spirit world. And I just want to tell you thank you because getting close to your birthday, you're a good person, and I know that you try to help people with your show, but it's a real thing. But stay away from Ouija boards.
You got it,
play
Albert. Spot
with
on.
Communicate with the spirit world because they'll get you, and they'll stay inside and wreck your life. But the interesting thing is that it's been for a long time, and Faraday is a brilliant scientist. The ideomotor phenomenon. Look it up in Wiki.
By the way, Albert, you sound just like Pat Boone, the actor-singer. Anybody ever tell you that?
You're kind. I liked him when I was growing up. He had a white suit, and he was nice, and so I wanted to
always. He's a good guy. Varla, what do you think of this? I think he's spot on.
Yeah, I think there's something to, you know, there's been a lot of very renowned scientists who have dabbled with or tried to, in and of their scientific work, tried to make contact or find some evidence, including Thomas Edison. He was well known for doing experiments trying to pick up on other wavelengths and entities to see if someone could communicate through electricity or through other kind of devices. I think where I differ is that I don't think that the Ouija board itself is evil. I don't think that there's necessarily...
It's a tool.
But I do think it's a tool, and I think that some people, just like some people have the second sight, people have different, you know, they're vulnerable to different things. And so, I mean, obviously you, George, you're a magnet. You're a magnet for all kinds of energy and people that kind of surround you. So it makes sense that a Ouija board in your life would cause a bit of mayhem because it's a tool and it's sort of a magnetic conduit. Now, somebody who has a little bit of a, you know, maybe their experience with it is something more like, now, I don't use the Ouija board currently, but I have used it in my adult life. And I have had a few strange experiences.
I just think they bring in things. You got to be careful, Vala.
I do. You have to be careful, and I think that's true of any kind of endeavor you take in which you're trying to find
sure.
an answer from, you know, some other great beyond. You have to do that responsibly. But I think he has a great point about, you know, the connection between science and trying to find ways to communicate or find some evidence. And that's sort of the great quest, right? I mean, thousands of shows are dedicated to trying to find that evidence, that, you know, that absolute certainty, that EVP recording. And just like I had said earlier, you know, so many people might be skeptics until they have that experience. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes, you know, it could be what could be frightening to someone might not be frightening to somebody else. It might be enlightening to them. And everybody kind of has their own individual experience with it.
Like you don't believe in God unless you need him. You know what?
Yeah, that's convenient.
Please, God, please. Back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a trance medium by the name of Leonora Piper, who was investigated by American and British psychic research organizations. What do you think of her? Because you've looked at her.
Yeah, she's a really interesting case because the way I kind of found out about her is that I read this paper that was called, I think it was called The Investigation of Leonora Piper. And she was this very well-to-do, older by Victorian standards, meaning she, I think, was in her late 40s when the investigation began. So by then, you know, she was an older woman by society standards. And the thing about her that's really interesting, and people who have more of a background in medical science will really find this fascinating. She was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Shortly after being diagnosed with this tumor, she began to go into trances, and she would channel a number of entities, including Abraham Lincoln, an African slave, a stage actress.
But she passed the muster, didn't she?
I'm sorry?
She passed the muster whenever they checked her out.
So what they did is for 15 years, these two cyclical, institutes for cyclical investigation, they tested her. They asked her questions out of trance. They asked her questions in trance. They tried things in other languages. They brought people in who were interpreters. They brought in people who could speak the native tongue that she was speaking in that nobody else recognized. They tried to trip her up. They attended things. They popped in on her. They interviewed her constantly over a 15-year period, and no one could prove that she wasn't in trance, that her story didn't check out, so to speak. And so I love the story because, you know, it's presented as the investigation of Mrs. Leonora Piper. And she was this, you know, she's a pretty well-to-do woman. And she didn't really have any of these experiences, but we know because of the era and the spiritualist movement that this was popular culture, that, you know, you might attend a seance. Oh, just come over to my house and we're going to have a seance. You know, it's just something fun to do. And for some people, they would sort of walk into those situations and fall immediately into a trance or into some kind of, just like certain people today might walk into a room of, you know, maybe a group of people praying or a group of people who are all meditating and just instantly kind of be able to pick up on that wavelength or the energy of a particular person. She was very, very vulnerable to whatever was kind of swirling around in the room at the time, I guess. And so I just love this image of this otherwise very stalwart sort of Victorian woman in her corset sort of passing out a French African slave.
And they all looked legitimate in those days, dressed up like that. Yeah, for some reason, the 1800s made you look more psychic.
It's the high collar.
It's something. Valar, we are almost out of time. Those of you on hold, Donna will check with you to see if you want to stick around for open lines. But give us your website, first of all, would you?
It's varlaventura.net.
Simple as that. And the name of this book is called Varla Ventura's Paranormal Parlor. She also has several others, including The Book of the Bizarre and Beyond Bizarre. And also, I remember talking to you years ago about mermaids. Remember that?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have a book called The Mermaid.
Don't you have a mermaid outfit for yourself, if I remember?
I have a... it's not a very successful one. I've never actually been able to get one of those full-on...
Fins and all that?
Yeah, yeah. I've never been able to actually train and like swim in one.
Let's hope not. We don't want you to sink, Varla.
It's
thanks.
Incredibly difficult. Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show. Open lines next on Coast to Coast AM.